DW Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On today's programme, a DW investigation shows German-built weapons and technology are being used in the Yemen conflict, in which tens of thousands of civilians have been killed. Also, pedophilia in the Catholic Church.
I think the Catholic Church is in the process of understanding the seriousness of pedophilia. But for a long time, within the church, it was considered like adultery and homosexuality, on the same level of sin.
Homelessness is up in Ireland, the UK and France, but Finland has pretty much eradicated the issue. We find out why and a lot more coming up on Inside Europe. Many Catholics hope the Vatican summit on sex abuse will lead to tangible change in the church and shed a spotlight on new countries where scandals may have happened. For others, it's a revisit to a painful past. That's the case of nominally Catholic France, where last week's four-day meeting coincided with the release of an explosive movie on a pedophilia scandal still very much in the headlines, along with a book on another hot-button issue facing the church, homosexuality in the priesthood. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Je m'appelle Alexandre Guérin, père de 5 enfants. Je découvre il y a un mois par hasard que le père
François Ozon's Grâce à Dieu, or By the Grace of God, got the go-ahead just hours before its release, despite efforts to block it in court. The movie is based on a real scandal still rocking the French Catholic Church. It involves priest Bernard Prénat, accused of molesting dozens of boys during the 1980s and 90s. The Archbishop of Lyon, Cardinal Philippe Barbarin, is currently on trial on charges of failing to act against the accusations, charges he denies. A verdict is due next month. Father Prénat has confessed to molesting Boy Scouts. He is also due to go on trial later this year. The movie has already grabbed a top award at Berlin's International Film Festival. Here in France, it's drawing mixed reviews. Grâce à Dieu is both a bad documentary and an emotionally shattering movie, Le Figaro wrote. But the newspaper also praised the way the film explored the psychological toll of sexual attacks on victims and their families and the difficulty they had rebuilding their lives. The movie is not black and white. Director Ozon said in this radio interview that when he met the real-life protagonists, he realized everybody was a victim to a certain extent.
I think the Catholic Church is in the process of understanding the seriousness of pedophilia. But for a long time, within the church, it was considered like adultery and homosexuality on the same level of sin.
Ça fait plus de 30 ans, Alexandre.
Maman, il s'agit d'aujourd'hui, du père Prénat qui est toujours en contact avec des enfants.
Ozon invited the church hierarchy to the movie's preview in Lyon and got a surprisingly upbeat reaction. Here's Vincent Nemaud, spokesman for the French Bishops' Conference, on public TV.
Le film de François Ozon n'est pas un scandale.
François Ozon's movie is not a scandal. We see it as another stone in the fight against pedophilia.
French bishops have also agreed to award compensation to victims of sexual abuse whose cases fall outside the French statute of limitations. Like many other traditionally Catholic countries in Europe, France is moving increasingly further from the church. The country bans official surveys based on ethnic or religious affiliation, but private polls show that less than two-thirds of French declare themselves Catholic today, compared to nearly 90% in the early 1970s. Florence Charpentier, waiting to see the movie in downtown Paris, says she was raised Catholic, but does not consider herself so now.
I was disgusted when I heard about the pedophilia scandal here, because it surpassed anything I could have imagined. But I wasn't surprised. I heard a lot of stories about Catholic schools.
Charpentier says she hopes the church will end celibacy for priests. She thinks that could solve a lot of problems.
Oui, catholique, oui. Pratiquante, non.
Another moviegoer, Catherine Sasson, considers herself a non-practicing Catholic.
Je pense que ça peut changer la mentalité des gens, oui.
I hope this movie can change people's attitudes. Because to put images with words, that's strong. And I think it can make people aware of what could happen.
C'est difficile de mettre la bonne distance et les bons filtres.
François Deveau, head of victims group La Parole Libérée, and who is portrayed in the movie, told French TV he hopes the church finally takes action on a scandal that has tainted the institution for centuries. Meanwhile, a separate but controversial book on homosexuality in the church hit stores on Thursday. Titled In the Closet of the Vatican and reportedly based on hundreds of interviews, it exposes a gay subculture and duplicity allegedly rife in the Catholic hierarchy. Studies show there is no correlation between homosexuality and sexual abuse, although some members of the Catholic clergy suggest otherwise.
C'est une majorité silencieuse dans le sens où chacun protège son petit secret.
In interviews like this one, gay author Frédéric Martel describes a so-called silent majority in the church where he claims members are protecting their sexual status by pretending to be homophobic. And indeed, homosexuality in the church was one of the central topics of discussions during the Vatican summit, even though it wasn't on the official agenda. Martel's book has drawn criticism, however, and some believe it may undermine efforts to gain acceptance of homosexuality within the church. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
From the studios of Germany's international broadcaster, DW, this is Inside Europe.
A United Nations conference secured around €2.5 billion in pledges on Tuesday to aid the millions of people facing starvation in war-torn Yemen. Civilians have borne the brunt of a war that has raged there since 2015. Germany promised $114 million to that UN fund. Germany prides itself on its restrictive export policies, which ban arms sales to countries involved in armed conflict. But as Germany promises money to the victims in Yemen, a DW investigation shows the Saudi-led coalition uses German-built weapons and technology in the conflict, which the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. One of the investigators in the German arms probe is DW reporter Nina Werkhäuser. Hello, Nina.
Hello.
Tell us more about what you found in the investigation.
Well, our investigation has provided evidence that German weapons and components are being used in the Yemen war by Saudi Arabia and also by the United Arab Emirates, who lead the ground offensive in this war. We found weapon stations of German manufacturers on armored vehicles. We found warships built in Germany, which operate in Yemeni ports. We found evidence of fighter aircraft partly made of German components flying over Yemen. So that means we found clear evidence that such weapon systems are being used in that cruel war.
The German government apparently ignored its own guidelines, even as tens of thousands of civilians have been killed in Yemen. Is that what's going on? Or, I mean, are the guidelines just some kind of government virtue signalling?
Yeah, it seems they are. The guidelines are very clear about it. It's forbidden to export weapons to countries involved in armed conflicts, such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And the Yemen war started in 2015, but the German government continued to allow arms sales to both countries, and that's clearly against the guidelines. These are guidelines. They are not that binding, but the German government prides itself of having such strict guidelines and then doesn't follow them. And also, the weapons sold must remain in the country that bought them and can't be taken to another country in order to fight. So that's a second rule that's being broken there by the Emirates, for example.
So who's at fault in this situation? Is it the weapons manufacturers or the German government?
Mostly the government's fault, because they have to approve of every single arms export. That's the legal regulations. And they can say no, and they do say no in certain cases. So if they say yes, and the company's interest, of course, is to sell these weapons, and if the government says yes, they just sell them. So it's the government who plays the major role or has the responsibility to say no.
And have they said anything about this?
Well, we asked them had they any knowledge of German weapons or components being used in the Yemen war, and they said, no, we don't. That's surprising, because if we can find evidence, why can't they? They have secret services, they have ministries and everything. And we asked them again today and confronted them with our findings, and they said, no, we have no evidence, and we will check on that, but we don't know anything about it.
Tell me more about the project partners in your investigation.
Our project partners, we work together with German media and European investigative journalists. We sat together in a room and analyzed material from sources that are freely available on the internet, such as Twitter messages, videos we found on YouTube, satellite imagery on Google Earth. And then we tried to find and identify German weapons and components, and then pinpointed the location to make sure that the material actually was from Yemen and not from somewhere else. And we spent 2 weeks doing that all together, and afterwards put together our reports, who came out in different German media and also in the Netherlands. And Bellingcat was involved, an investigative bureau based in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping the project will achieve?
I personally hope that the German government will rethink their position on arms exports and stop allowing arms sales to countries who are involved in wars.
Nina Verkhoizer, thank you very much for coming on Inside Europe.
Thank you.
That's DW reporter Nina Verkhoizer, one of the investigators in the German arms probe. This is Inside Europe, and coming up next, Hungary's new anti-immigration campaign, in which Prime Minister Viktor Orbán says that the EU has not learnt anything from the horrible terror attacks of the past years and wants to bring even more migrants to Europe. More on that in less than 1 minute. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. At least two European Union leaders have visited Hungary in recent days. It comes amid mounting concerns about a new government anti-migration campaign against the bloc's leadership. Among those visiting Budapest were the European Commission's Vice President and the Netherlands Justice Minister, two Dutchmen who condemn what they view as the Hungarian government's threat to the EU's democratic values. But as Stefan Boss reports from Hungary, the perceived authoritarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, has defended his policies.
During his visit to Budapest, Dutch Justice Minister Ferdinand Grapperhaus expressed his concern over a number of issues, including corruption. He urged Hungary's right-wing government to tackle the widespread misuse of European Union funds that EU investigators say even involves the son-in-law of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. Grapperhaus also condemned an overhaul of the justice system that would give Orbán's government control over judges hearing cases ranging from corruption to police abuse. Critics of Orbán say he is trying to divert attention away from these policies with a new public campaign that accuses EU leaders of threatening Hungary's security. That's why Dutch politician Grapperhaus expressed mixed feelings about his talks with the Hungarian ministers of justice and the interior.
Hungary has recently passed a law in which the independence of the judiciary is, in my view, at stake. There are other discussions as well as regards to how are you going to properly implement anti-corruption policies, how are you going to work together within the EU to see to it that EU funding is truly coming at the spot where it is meant to be. We have to listen to each other, but also be open to criticism.
Prior to his visit, fellow Dutchman Frans Timmermans, the Vice President of the European Commission, the EU's executive, met Hungarian activists and the opposition Socialist Party in Budapest. Their talks focusing on what they say is a government crackdown on democratic institutions. Timmermans wasn't exactly welcomed by Orbán's government. That's perhaps hardly surprising. the Hungarian government has just launched a new anti-immigration campaign. The country has been plastered with posters showing pictures of the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker and Hungarian-American billionaire George Soros with the caption, "You too have the right to know what Brussels is planning to do." The campaign comes in the lead-up to elections to the European Parliament in May. Combined with ads in newspapers and on television, the campaign claims that the EU promotes mass migration by weakening borders and other measures. Like many other senior EU officials, Timmermans has dismissed the accusations.
You have the truth, which is in the ballpark. You have the truth slightly out of the ballpark. But this is something in a completely different universe. And I honestly believe that the President of the European Commission, an EU institution that serves all member states, does not deserve to be treated in this way by one of the member states' governments. I was twice in the Prime Minister's speech, such great honour. So who knows? There might even be a poster. I'm probably too ugly to put on a poster.
In addition to the posters, a one-page letter has now been mailed to every household here. In it, Orbán says that the EU has not learned anything from the horrible terror attacks of the past years and wants to bring even more migrants to Europe. Some Hungarians are fighting back. Graffiti is springing up, highlighting the problems closer to home, such as corruption and violations of the rule of law, with slogans such as "Orbán thief." And the opposition Momentum Movement Party places stickers on government posters with texts like "Every sixth Hungarian child is born abroad." That's a reference to hundreds of thousands of young Hungarians who have left the country in recent years amid concerns over the political climate and declining living standards. Stefan Bos, DW, Budapest.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn. The number of people sleeping rough in Germany has increased by 35% over the past 2 years. That's according to figures from the World Economic Forum. Numbers have also been increasing in Ireland, the UK, France and the United States. In Finland, though, they've pretty much eradicated the issue thanks to a national policy called Housing First. John Lawrenson travelled to Helsinki to take a look at how it works.
This is my place. This is so small.
Going round Juri Becker's place at the Unali and Queer housing unit near the centre of Helsinki, it's a bit of a mess with cigarette butts and a skull collection, not real ones. By the bed there's a Bible and a bong. In the middle of the room, a massive TV showing a church service in a wood. Half the screen is blacked out where one of his friends shot it with a pellet gun. Juri's flat, like Juri's life, like all of our lives, only perhaps a little more so, is a work in progress. But he's already come a long way.
I was homeless for 8 years. I had a few kids, you know, wife, family, got divorced, got homeless. I had to quit the job because I didn't have a place to live, you know. In Finland, you get a few years this. It's called ansiosidonnainen in Finnish. I don't know what is it in English.
Maybe unemployment benefit?
Yeah. And I got that for a few years and then they cut it. Then I was like homeless and without money. And that's when it all started falling down, you know.
Yeah. How bad did things get?
No, it got so bad that I started using drugs, sleeping in people's, you know, door.
Entrance?
Yeah, the entrance.
Entrance ways?
Yeah, in the high buildings.
How have things changed for you since you came here?
Lots better. I'm taking care of one of the residents here. This guy, he's very sick. Mm. And I've been his carer. He's been getting so much better. He weighed 115 kilograms.
Wow.
And now he's 70 kilograms.
Okay.
And he's all muscle and... I'm so happy, man.
Yeah, satisfying.
It's very satisfying, yeah.
Alcohol okay?
Yeah, no alcohol, yeah. Just then and there. When I turned 40, maybe, I was drunk then. And, of course, when Finland won the world champion in ice hockey, of course, then I got drunk.
What about the drugs?
Oh, I'm at...
rehab?
Yeah, rehab, yeah. I'm doing great, yeah. This is my rehab... medicine.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What's that?
It comes
MET.
In this
is that methadone or something?
Yeah.
Yuri is one of 12,000 people so far who've been housed thanks to an interesting list of organisations that came together to fix the homelessness problem. They include the Finnish state, Finland's five largest cities, the Finnish Red Cross, the Finnish Mental Health Association, the Finnish Evangelical Church, the Finnish Construction Workers Trade Union, and the Finnish construction industry. They buy and build flats to rent them out to homeless people who often pay thanks to housing benefit. These flats are attributed according to the principle they call housing first. Finland used to, and most countries still do, use a step principle. Homeless people are supposed to move from emergency shelters to hostels and other temporary accommodation until they can prove they've sorted out their problems with drugs, for example, deserve public housing, are housing friendly. Housing First turns this logic on its head, as Juha Karkinen, chief executive of the Y Foundation, one of the main Housing First housing providers, explains.
The philosophy is that every homeless person has a history of their own, but what's common to them, everybody needs home. You need to have a stable, secure place. In our thinking, it means a rental apartment of your own, where you have your own rental contract, and it's unconditional, so you are not expected to be housing ready before you move to the flat. If you have social and health problems, they can be better dealt with when you have a safe place to live.
3,500 people have been housed thanks to this program since 2008. Do you know how much it's cost?
Around 280 million euros overall. And most of it has been for building new affordable social housing. We have some scientific evaluation that shows that when you get proper housing, the society gets savings around 15,000 euros per one person per 1 year. The savings are mainly in the use of different services, for example, special health care, police, justice system, social welfare. And of course, it's the human point or ethical point which is still the most important, that we can't accept homelessness as a permanent phenomenon in our societies.
Anyway, I collect knives, guns, and I'm a big fan of skulls.
Back at Yuri's place, I ask him about the lethal weapons hanging from his wall.
You can see skulls.
Well, this isn't very reassuring,
skulls.
Yuri.
Yeah.
You have got a lot of skulls.
Yeah. I like skulls in my fingers and, you know.
Yeah.
Every.
Yeah, on your T-shirt.
Yeah. It's your thing. My thing.
Yeah. Can you imagine the situation you would be in if you hadn't been given this place?
I can imagine, yeah. It's dark. It's very dark. I've lived in with friends who uses drugs. So maybe if I weren't here, I would be there with someone who uses drugs. And if they're on the table, you can't resist anymore. So that's why these kind of places are important. Now I go and see my kids every 2 weeks and be in contact with my family all the time. And when you get an apartment, you know, everything changes. It changes you and it changes everything around you.
John Lawrenson, DW, Helsinki.
If you'd like to contact the show, we would love to hear from you. Our email address is europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the next half an hour, Greek divers work to get single-use plastic bottles and microplastics out of the Mediterranean Sea. Christian worshippers in Ukraine clash after a church split.
This is ripping the community apart. People have stopped speaking to each other. We even have a husband who's threatening to throw his wife out for her religious beliefs. They called us antichrists.
Also coming up, the world's biggest dogs dinner in London to protest Brexit.
Who let the dogs out?
Stay tuned for these stories and more.
From the studios of Germany's international broadcaster, DW, this is Inside Europe.
The European Union is waging a war on plastic waste, from single-use items like plastic bags and bottles to the microplastics found in cosmetics and detergents. A lot of this plastic ends up in the Mediterranean Sea, which Greek divers are trying to clean up. They're calling themselves the trash collectors of the sea. Here's Joanna Kakissis.
Greece has the longest coastline in the European Union and one of the worst recycling rates. George Sadalakos sees what his fellow Greeks throw away.
They consume plastics and all this kind of stuff. You know, they have to understand that most of them end up into the sea. Around 80% of litter produced in our homes ends up in the sea.
Sadalakos leads a group called Aegean Rebreath. They are volunteer divers who collect rubbish from the sea around Greece. On a recent dive, the group collected trash off the island of Poros.
You know, it makes me upset seeing that the seabed includes everything. There is everything inside there. Like the whole seabed is covered by litter.
The Worldwide Fund for Nature, known as the WWF, estimates that 95% of the waste in the Mediterranean Sea and on its beaches is plastic. At the WWF's Greece office in Athens, Achilles Plitharas says the task is huge.
The plastics debate has the same, more or less, conflicts and barriers with the climate change debate. We all know how bad the things are, but at the same time, we haven't found a common solution and we didn't discover yet a common path to work on.
And Greece, he says, has one of the EU's biggest plastic waste problems. A 2016 study by the EU showed that each Greek used about 300 plastic bags a year. By comparison, a Finn used just 4.
Only 10 to 12% of the plastics that comes into the Greek market are currently recycled.
Is that very low compared to others?
It is. It's one of the lowest level in the European Union.
A 4-cent charge on plastic bags in supermarkets has contributed to a big reduction in their use. But Kostas Virganelakis still sees a lot of them at Watt, the private recycling company he runs.
We received approximately 250 tons on a daily basis. So it's like one mountain of waste that comes here on a daily basis. If our plant was not here, then all this waste could go directly to the landfill.
Watt employees collect recycling from blue bins where Greeks are supposed to place the recycling. But Veronelaki says he's seen some unbelievable things in the recycling bins, including the corpse of an endangered turtle. He takes me on a tour of the recycling plant outside Athens.
This is the material down here.
Oh, wow.
You can see a lot of organic material, lemon and orange residues, soil.
Yeah.
Broken ceramics, all of these, they're not recyclables. So eventually they will be disposed to the landfill.
He adds that Greeks still haven't gotten used to recycling, so plastic bags, bottles and straws often get thrown into garbage bins. Francisco Bianchi is an environmentalist from Spain, and he lives in Athens with his Greek wife and their young son. This family recycles, but while vacationing on a Greek island a couple of years ago, they noticed a problem.
No recycling facilities in the islands, or in most of the islands. We were shocked for the amount of plastic we produce in only 1 week. That's when we start thinking in what to do about it.
Bianchi and his wife now run Plasticurio, a workshop in central Athens that upcycles plastics. Bianchi crushes plastic bottles in a machine that's like a shredder.
That's it.
Where is it? Where does it come out? Oh, in there.
It goes out down here. Mm-hmm. And this is what it looks like.
Oh my God, it looks like a bunch of crystals. Okay.
He melts the crystals and makes all sorts of things. Filament for 3D printing, reproductions of Cycladic art, lamps. He shows me a block made out of upcycled plastic.
If you look to this block,
yeah,
it resembles marble.
Yes, it looks just like marble, yeah.
And it's heavy. Probably will last longer than the marble.
Really? Oh, wow. What do people make with the new marble?
You can make anything. You can make anything. People that wants to have furniture outdoors, so plastic lumber. So we create like planks and things, or squares or tiles.
But he acknowledges that his upcycling business is too small to really make a dent in the mountain of plastic gathered in landfills and thrown into the sea. Back on the island of Poros, the Aegean rebreath divers are trying to heave a huge tire from the sea onto the main port. They also bring up a shopping cart, an engine, a couple of cassette recorders, drinking glasses, and of course a lot more plastic. All this plastic washes up on beaches in a country that lives off tourism. George Sadelakos, the lead diver for Aegean Rebreath, has seen endangered sea turtles get tangled up in the plastic. He sees fish eating it.
You know, when we dive, we see parts, plastic bags, almost turn into microplastics floating around, and fish is eating this microplastic. Whatever we throw into the sea, we get it back, and we get it back to our stomachs.
His team empties out the litter onto the main pier on Poros in the hopes that those walking by will see what's been thrown away and maybe change their habits. Nicoleta Karadima, an 84-year-old grandmother holding two cloth bags of vegetables, gasps when she sees the trash. I can't believe we're throwing all that in the sea, she says. I swim in that sea. That is our sea. Joanna Kakis is DW on the island of Poros, Greece.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow is within its rights to do everything it can to protect freedom of religion in Ukraine. He's reacting to growing tensions in Ukraine between believers of the Kremlin-backed Russian Orthodox Church and followers of the newly created Independent Ukrainian Church, which was formally granted independence last month. It completed a historic split from Russian religious control that's been ongoing since 1868. Ukraine's churchgoers now face a choice. Take a leap into the unknown and join the new Ukrainian church, or stay with the Russian Orthodox Church, a church many critics say is indistinguishable from the Russian state. Our correspondent Nick Connolly has been to find out what happens when a community cannot agree.
It's with unmistakable pride that Father Oleg, a gaunt giant of a man, unfurls a scroll almost as long as he is tall. It's covered in a dense script, all colourful cursives, and full of ornament. What sounds like a proclamation from a faraway century was actually signed just a few weeks ago. With the stroke of a pen, the leader of the world's Orthodox Christians, Patriarch Bartholomew, recognised the independence of Ukraine's Orthodox Church from Russia. Since then, copies of the charter have been doing the rounds up and down the land as the new church fights for believers' allegiance. Here in the village of Bronitsa, it's the congregation's first opportunity to set eyes on their new Ukrainian Orthodox priest.
Amen.
Previously, only the Ukrainian branch of Russia's Moscow Patriarchy was recognized by its international brethren. Now the country has an internationally recognized church without ties of hierarchy or tradition to its northern neighbor, Russia, a neighbor with which Ukraine has been in a state of de facto war for the past 5 years. Believers must now choose: break with the habits of a lifetime or stay with a church increasingly cast as hostile to Ukraine's sovereignty. The residents of Bronitsa are discovering what happens when a congregation can't agree. The wooden church of St. John the Baptist has stood at the centre of Bronitsa for over 150 years, its golden domes visible from most places in the village. Inside, only the electric heaters make it clear that we're in the 21st century. Since it was built, the church has belonged to the Moscow Patriarchy. In charge of it for the past 6 months was Father Serhii, a young priest with a sparse ginger beard. He arrives to meet us in front of his former church in a battered Soviet-era car. Father Serhii describes the process that saw the building transferred to the new Ukrainian church as a mafia-style raid. Sounds of a standoff, captured on a mobile phone by one of its participants. Just days after the decision in Istanbul to recognize the independent Ukrainian church, Bronitsa gained a second priest, Father Oleg. But still, it only had one church. With their supporters in tow, the two priests came face to face on the steps of the church, a lone policeman and the village's mayor looking on from the sidelines. The authorities' response was simple: sealing off the church to both sides. Quite literally so. Soon, official government seals covered every door to the building. But when supporters of the new church presented a petition signed by two-thirds of the congregation, Bronitsa's mayor allowed supporters of the new church to change the locks. Father Serhii didn't even have to return his keys. Father Serhii tells us the fact that no one came to blows as tempers flared was only down to the police presence. But the impact, he worries, is already being felt.
This is ripping the community apart. People have stopped speaking to each other. We even have a husband who's threatening to throw his wife out for her religious beliefs. They called us antichrists.
For now, Father Serhii and his small remaining congregation, most of them women in their 60s and 70s, have retreated to the other end of the village. A wooden cottage, uninhabited for years, now serves as their place of worship. Inside, colourful wallpaper hastily put up and a wood-burning stove do little to lift the mood or the temperatures. Wrapped up in thick winter coats, the 20 or so parishioners listen to the prayers standing. A prayer for the health of the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, a man many in Ukraine think is too close to the Kremlin and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Someone Ukrainian believers shouldn't be praying for, the critics say. As we talk to members of the congregation outside, feelings are running high. We talk to one elderly churchgoer, and within a matter of minutes we're surrounded, as others hurry to join in, talking over each other, determined to get their point of view across. Some are defiant, but for others, it's all just too much.
We had a funeral the other day. The people there were split in two. Each side kept to itself. I could never have imagined that I'd end up going to pray in a shack.
We return to the Church of St. John the Baptist at the close of Father Oleg's first full Sunday service. Does he feel queasy about how his predecessor was treated, we ask?
This is all about the congregation. They have decided which church they want to belong to. The majority has made its choice. I think the others will be back with us very soon.
As the congregation, noticeably younger and more numerous than the other, leaves the village church, we ask what motivated them to take this leap into the unknown.
We have a Ukrainian church, a church that's truly independent of Russia, the country that's attacking us. We are not praying for their soldiers anymore.
We want to talk to God in Ukrainian, not in any other language. We want a Ukrainian priest, a Ukrainian church. The Russians are sending tanks against us, killing our children and grandchildren. We don't want the Russian church here. No way. the others will come back and will be waiting for them with open arms.
For the moment, that seems far-fetched. Neither congregation shows any appetite for sharing the church, let alone praying together. And Father Serhii plans to take his fight to the courts. The villagers, he says, were tricked into signing the petition. He's convinced a new vote would bring a different result. But he tells us he'd rather get back to his old church without lawyers, relying instead on intervention of a different kind.
I hope people will eventually understand what they've done, repent, and return to the fold of the true church.
Nick Connolly reporting for DW. We've got more from Russia. We've got the Kremlin crackdown on music coming up. And also, as promised, the world's biggest dog's dinner in London to protest Brexit.
Who let the dogs out?
That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. This is Inside Europe. British Prime Minister Theresa May is still seeking changes to a withdrawal agreement struck with the European Union late last year, which she hopes will be enough to get it through Parliament's lower House of Commons. But if she fails, she promised MPs they will vote on March 13th and 14th on whether to leave the bloc with no deal at all, or perhaps more likely to seek a short delay. Business leaders are saying a delay to Brexit will be a further annoyance. Critics are saying she's made a dog's dinner of Brexit. Even the dogs on the streets are barking mad. So says Daniel Elkin, who's founded the weekend's Wooferendum rally in London. Hello, Daniel.
Hi there.
So hundreds of dogs and their two-legged companions, together with some lawmakers and celebrities, are holding the world's biggest dog's dinner to demand that the UK government pull the country back from the brink of a no-deal Brexit disaster and give the UK the option to stop Brexit. What's all that about? Why did you decide to set this up?
Well, I mean, Brexit is such an important issue facing this country, and yet there's so many people that feel they can't even talk about it. It's dry, it's divisive. So I decided to see what dogs thought about Brexit, and it turns out they don't really like it.
But dogs don't think, though, really, do they?
You can't put a dog in front of a sign that it doesn't agree with. I've tried.
What kind of signs do the dogs have?
Stop Brexit, Wooferendum. I think the images really had an effect on people, and it kind of lightened the dry, boring debate. Mm-hmm. And actually kind of got people engaged. So people that would never have spoken out about it before publicly would be able to post pictures of their own dog mm-hmm. with their own signs, and that kind of caught fire a little bit.
You say that Brexit is likely to lead to a shortage of skilled vets and vet nurses, rising cost for animal health and pet food products, and even the end of the EU passport scheme. These are pretty serious things that could happen, you say. Why do you think that this might happen?
Well, the campaign itself, the Wooferendum campaign, was kind of started as a buy the dogs for the people. But the greater you realise Brexit will be a disaster for that. So, for example, 50% of new vet registrations are from countries, from the EU27 countries. That's in the UK. 25% of all vets for domestic animals are from the EU27 countries. And 95% of the vets who work in public health in abattoirs are from the EU27 countries. You think what happens if things get much more difficult for people for those countries to come or want to come to the UK to work, and we see a shortage. It's already difficult for pet owners to find vets, and the costs are already high. And when you think of the rising cost of medicines, that's another way that animal welfare and pet welfare is going to suffer.
But haven't they said that, you know, EU citizens living and working in the UK and vice versa, that they're going to be OK, that it's going to be sorted out and, you know, they just need to work out the finer detail. But it looks as though, like, that's going to be OK. That's not going to be a major issue.
Fingers crossed, but that's for the ones that are here. What about people that want to come? What about how attractive it is for real talent to come and work here? You know, when you talk to vets who work in the UK, they say one of the really great things about having people come from other countries is that you share expertise. You don't just do it the British way. You learn how the French or the Spanish or the Greeks do it, because you have a pool of vets that's much broader. And that, of course, goes across any kind of industry. We need to share our expertise and learn from each other.
Daniel Elkin, thank you very much for joining us on Inside Europe.
Thanks very much.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. In the days of the Soviet Union, young people had to trade black market records to get their hands on Western pop music. Soviet bureaucrats branded reams of music as undesirable. They said AC/DC and Julio Iglesias propagated neo-fascism, and the village people promoted violence. That's what they said. But in today's Russia, things are freer, of course. But recently, many young Russian bands were given a stark reminder of Soviet cultural control. Last year, the authorities shut down more than 40 concerts by a broad range of bands. Musicians were accused of extremism and promoting suicide or protests. The Russian electro duo iSpeak were also hit by the crackdown, even though most of their music isn't explicitly political. To find out more, DW's Emily Sherwin joined the band for part of their Russian tour.
"You can't ban music," the crowd chants at this concert by the Russian band iSpeak. Anastasia Kristina and Nikolai Kostilyov say the authorities shut down around half the concerts of their recent tour. They say they were repeatedly searched and questioned, and even arrested for several hours in Siberia. Nikolai Kostilyov says they almost got used to seeing police officers turn up at their concerts.
"It felt completely surreal. We sing a few songs and the secret services chase us through the whole city. Yes, some of our songs do have a political message, but the political stuff is such a small percentage of our work. So you think to yourself, what would happen if we were actually a political group? They wouldn't let us perform at all."
The band says the problems presumably started because of their song called «Смерти больше нет», or «Death No More». "I pour kerosene into my eyes. The whole of Russia is watching me. Let it all burn." In the video, Anastasia Kresnina sings these lyrics while pouring gasoline over herself outside the seat of the Russian government. The band also eats raw meat in front of Lenin's mausoleum on Red Square and drinks blood outside the Kremlin walls. The images are shocking in the Russian context, and iSpeak certainly know that. When they first posted the newly released video on their Facebook page, they wrote, "Hope the Russian government won't block it. Lol." iSpeak isn't the only group that's recently had problems with the authorities. Last year, over 40 concerts were shut down. Musicians of all genres were accused of extremism. In December, dozens of artists took to the stage against the tough stance of the Kremlin, including a concert supporting the band iSpeak. But while the crackdown has created a huge sense of solidarity, it's also shaken the music scene. as some of the performers explained backstage at the gig.
Lately, there seems to be an unspoken rule for musicians. If you so much as touch on politics, you'll have problems.
The situation would make any musician want to write about it. It politicizes people who otherwise wouldn't be interested in political protest at all.
Vladimir Putin seems to know this as well. At a meeting of the Arts Council at the end of last year, the Russian president criticized the crackdown and signaled a change in the Kremlin's strategy towards youth culture.
Rap and other modern music is based on three pillars: sex, drugs, and protest. Our biggest concern is the drugs, of course. They clearly lead to a degradation of the entire society. If this music is impossible to stop, then we have to lead and direct it properly.
The question is how to do that. Putin has now instructed his administration to come up with a plan to support modern music by September. Political scientist and art historian Ilya Grashchenkov thinks the debate about music reveals issues key to the current government's survival. After all, many of the demonstrators at recent opposition protests in Russia have been young people.
What we've seen so far is an attempt by the Kremlin to label anything it doesn't understand as non-existent, useless, and wrong. But now the main thing is for it to re-establish communication with the young generation, to understand who they are, what they want, and how to deal with that.
Back at Ice Peak's concert, the audience is being asked to shout along if they're in pain. The crowd sings along to the lyrics of Ice Peak's hit song, Skazka, or Fairy Tale. I'm from a Russian fairy tale, I don't care where you are from. I'm not scared of daylight, there's enough darkness everywhere anyway, they chant. Many in the crowd here are young, and they say they relate to the gloomy, gothic hopelessness of the band's lyrics and music. Today's concert goes ahead without problems. The band says they were always determined to continue touring, despite all the problems they had with the authorities. And Anastasia Kreslina puts what happened down to a clash of generations.
People who grew up with the internet and who don't watch state-controlled TV have grown up and have learned how to think critically. State propaganda doesn't work on them. The government's noticed that they've noticed they're losing control. Now they've decided to correct youth culture, to somehow bend it back into its old shape. But the process can't be stopped anymore, and we certainly won't censor ourselves.
No. Now we want to be even harsher, even more radical, and even more interesting.
Ice Peak's dark and sarcastic music has clearly touched a nerve with young Russians. Their singles have millions of views on YouTube, and their trouble with the authorities has gotten the band a lot of publicity. Instead of silencing them, it has made them one of the voices of a new generation the Kremlin is now pushing to connect with. Emily Sherwin, DW, Rizan.
And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini. The sound technician is Gert Georgi, and I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of this show on Spotify and SoundCloud and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.